I'd go to Cook County Jail and see what the inside of a jail was like. And I knew what would happen. I knew half of those people. I didn't dare go. So I'd have been greeted immediately like, hello, fellow worker, what are you doing here? And that would have been the end of my career as a New Jersey industry. So I told him what was the truth, that I had been inside a jail in New Jersey, and it made me sick to see those men in cages, and I couldn't go through it again. As a matter of fact, as an adjuster, I was in county jail most of the time, interviewing burglars on what they had done with that loot. Things of that sort.
So you were in Chicago during the IWW trial?
Yeah,
then?
Well, I left, I was there during it, yes, because I remember I was, what a terrible shock it was to see him get 20 years apiece.
Were you able
that
to
was
go
when
to
Bill Haywood
trial?
Got it and then escaped, but others that I knew got 20 years and served him. And, I think, yes, I remember that day because I felt so terrible. I went out to the cemetery to see the grave of the Haymarket victims of martyrs and metal, all I could think of doing. And there was it was in Chicago that I had a post office box, and one day found among my mail a letter addressed to the district attorney, which showed that my mail had all been on his desk and somebody had pulled the day after I left, somebody blew up the post office with a bomb, and I'm sure that I was expected to be involved in that. And there was also a radical club there called the something or other Pudding Club. I knew some people who introduced me to it, and occasionally I'd go there. And there was one man I met that I know now must have been some kind of provocateur, and he kept advocating violence, and he kept insisting that he wanted to see me at such and such a meeting. So I finally got very suspicious of him, and I told him that the particular occasion he wanted me to go that I couldn't go, and I stayed away, and that was the day they raided the place and arrested everybody in.
Of the big IWW raid?
They weren't. It wasn't particularly IWW. No. It was just general radicals of every kind.
Now, that was fairly early. How were you already known as a radical? That was about 1918 then, wasn't it?
It was 1918.
Because you weren't yet... Really
I wasn't known, but that I would be in such a place would be enough. And then I called on Mrs. Parsons, who was the last surviving widow of the Haymarket people. And you see, I was with the Federated Press, which was always... No, I wasn't until 1921. But I must have had... Well, I did have all kinds of radical connections, thanks to my first marriage and all the anarchists I met and all that. So I presume my name somehow had gotten into the files. I must have a dossier at the FBI about this big. I don't know.
That's one of the advantages of living so long. You begin to confound them with your files.
No, I don't think that had much connection with it. But I have been very active in the Mooney case and also in the Schmidt and Kaplan cases, you know, the Los Angeles bombing at times.
Oh, now you were involved in the LA Times?
I did a lot of reporting later on because Schmidt and Kaplan weren't arrested until long after Schmidt was betrayed by the anarchist boy up in the home colony in Washington. And we got to know both Schmidt and Kaplan very well indeed. And Schmidt's sister Catherine was one of my very good friends. She died a long time ago.
So you covered their trial then?
Yeah. So I knew all of them. And when I was in Los Angeles, I went to the county jail and visited the McNamara's. So that would be enough to get my name in places. And before that, I'd been associating with the wrong kind of people. To the end of my 4 years or so in Boston, that I began to meet people from the left, and to say they were mostly anarchists, like that woman who taught me birth control. Mm-hmm. And that was all because of the man who became my first husband, because he had been associated. He was a beautiful combination of mystic, anarchist, and southern aristocrat. I insisted on being respected for all three.
The anarchists seem to have had a much more visible feminist ideology.
Oh, yes.
Than the other.
Yes, they always are very, very firm feminists. Of course, these were all the ones I knew were what they used to call philosophical anarchists. They didn't. They revered Johann Most, who was an activist, but they never did anything. Even Emma never threw. Of course, Berkman tried to kill Frick with a rubber revolver. Have you probably read Emma's autobiography? You know, she tried to become a prostitute so as to raise money for such. Well, anybody would pick up Emma, who must have been most unappetizing even in her youth. You remember this man who picked her up and gave her $20 and sent her home and told her she didn't qualify.
Now, you probably knew Berkman in San Francisco here, didn't you, when around the... he was involved in the Mooning Committee.
Well, I never... by the time I got to San Francisco, I should say that I came here as an insurance adjuster, and I was writing all kinds of left-wing stuff, and as I say, the Federal Press was founded in 1920, and I don't remember now how I first heard of it or how I got in touch with it, but at first I had just a sort of satirical column. And then after about 6 months, I think, they asked me if I would be their staff correspondent in the Bay Area, which I was until I died in 1956.
But you covered primarily...
I covered any kind of labor
in the Bay
news.
Area.
Oh, yeah, only in the Bay Area.
So, for instance, you...
Both sides of the Bay and Marin and the Peninsula. But I couldn't, as I say, you couldn't live on $20 a month. I was working all day. I couldn't go around. For 3.5 years, I was one of the few non-relief people on the Writers' Project of WPA. And then I did travel around. And then, of course, and at the same time, I was working for the Federated Press at that time. So I did often pick up news items when they sent me to Sacramento or San Jose or... I covered all the big cities. I wrote all the big cities in the California Guide. And they'd send me around to make a first-hand survey. And, of course, while I was there, I'd pick up anything, meet people that would give me some information. But regularly, I was just around here. And there was plenty. There was always something. There were always strikes, of course, all of which had to be covered. You'd go down to strike headquarters every day and see if there was any news. And I was lucky because as an insurance adjuster, as a claim adjuster, I was out all day. I just signed in the morning and took my cases and went out to see people. So if in the course of the day I wanted to stop in and see somebody about something else, nobody would know where I was until the Red Squad happened to be in at the same time.
Now, you covered the 1934 general strike too, didn't you?
That, my dear girl, I shall never forget because it was when Maynard had his stroke and I was covering it every day coming in. The day he died, I sent him my story as usual. Oh, no, I'll never forget that. I had 4 months when I was doing all that, and I was also the nurse and the cook and the housekeeper and everything.
Were you living in Sausalito?
We lived in Sausalito, yes. I came over every day. And then after we began to get a little better from his first stroke, our doctor, for some unknown reason, thought it would do him good to have all his teeth pulled. And so I had to bring him over, and he could always walk. We couldn't talk. And I had to bring him over every day to the dentist, and we'd come over in the ferry in those days, you know, and then go out in Market Street car, and we'd see a long line of the strikers coming out. And I remember very well when the general strike lasted for about 3 days, the funny signs in people's store windows saying going fishing or something like that.
The small shops also closed?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
everything closed. There were no streetcars. There were no buses then anyway. And all the department stores all closed. Everything was absolutely dead for about 3 days till they killed it.
But they actually, the general strike actually ended before the longshoremen won, didn't it?
Yes, I think so. But I was bloody Thursday. At that time, there was a kind of little bridge over the Embarcadero from the other side of the Embarcadero to the ferry building. And I stood on that and could see the corner of Stewart and Mason. In fact, I got a little whiff of the tear gas when they threw us. I didn't see the men actually killed, but I saw them, the police mop up. And of course, regularly, I knew by heart the corner where the bomb went off in 1916, and though I wasn't here then, you see. I didn't get here until 1918. But by that time, in many cases, it really started to hop. And I don't know how many hearings of one kind or another I covered.
Actually, all of radical circles were really unified around the Mooney case,
yeah.
Weren't they?
Well, and then, of course, there were all remember the criminal syndicalism law, and there were all those cases, Ford and Sir and all those. I covered all of those. I'd go up to San Quentin to see the victims, and I got so that I guess everybody knew me in San Quentin. Those days you couldn't go inside, you had to have the men brought out. But I also knew Duffy when he was warden, because his sister, Ethel Turner, was quite a well-known novelist at that time. I knew her through the Authors Guild. And I met him, and when I began writing true crime, I got to have a number of interviews with Duffy on some of my night's murders in there, especially Mrs. Pete, who was my pet murderess. The only case I know of where somebody was condemned to death and then commuted to life imprisonment and then let out on parole and then committed exactly the same kind of murder. That time she finally got in the gas chamber.
How did you begin to get involved in that kind of writing?
Well, I can't remember exactly, unless it goes back. I had always been interested in crime, and they see many of us did a great deal of very important pioneer work on the history of the death penalty. And all of which is in the Bancroft Library now. And I got interested in largely through him, and then I wrote a number of articles. And then I had a letter an article in one of Haldeman Julius's magazines called What the Detectives Detect, making fun of them. And I got a letter from one of the San Quentin inmates telling me how once when he was on the lam, he'd attended the detective's convention, nobody knew him. And then through him, I got to know several others in one way or another, and then going up every day to see Mooney and all. And I just got to be rather fascinated by crime, and at that time, there were a number of magazine markets for true crime articles, and there none left. Books, yes, but not articles. But I just began writing for the same magazine sometimes I was writing mystery stories for. And I'd been doing that since about 1920 or so, for the pulps. So, I guess way back then I was writing a whole series of detective stories for the pulp magazines. I guess I've always been interested in crime. Maybe I'm a born criminal myself. I don't know. Just getting my catharsis that way.
How about your science fiction work? How did you become interested that in
that? It was much later. In fact, when I first... That, I think, was largely because of Maynard's work in science, and I typed all his things and read his books and everything, and I just got interested in it. I'd never read any, which was proved when I began writing this stuff, and I'd send it in, and they'd send it back and say, that's old hat, that's been done over and over, it was all new to me. So then I began reading it, too. Now those are all science fiction anthologies I'm in.
What was the first science fiction you had published in what year?
I can't remember. I know have been publishing mystery fiction for, I should say, 50 years, but I think I started somewhere around 1938 or 40, something like that. I still do more mystery than I do science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So are magazines, for one thing. But I sort of alternate them. I do one and the other. I just send out the science fiction one now and work on a mystery.
Do you prefer your nonfiction writing to your
fiction? No, I prefer mystery. I'd rather write true crime than anything, but there's nowhere to sell it now, so I have to let it go. I have the only nonfiction in the Belcher memorial volume of mystery stories. I also have one. There was a double thing, one science fiction volume and one mystery volume. But they're all fiction, except I have one on the Morris murders. And all those things are my mystery and true crime anthologies. The great problem here is, what do you do with more books? I just got that wonderful encyclopedia of crime called Blood Letters and Bad Man.
I've been noticing the cover of it.
Yeah. It's quite a book. I haven't begun to read it. You don't read it through anymore. You read a dictionary. But he has photographs and biographical articles on thousands and thousands of them. It's going to be very useful for reference. He's 15 years writing it. I should think he would have been. In alphabetical order.
Oh.
All the way from Burton Abbott to a gangster named Willem.
What are the earliest dates?
He left out a lot. He doesn't try to cover all of them. I kept looking at some of the people I've written about that weren't in there, including dear Mrs. Pete. But he has plenty. Of course, some of them I know by heart, like Bunny and Clyde and Mrs. Barker and all that. And written books about it myself. He even put me in the bibliography, so.
Oh.
But it's really a magnificent piece of work.
It looks like a fantastic.
Fortunately, it was a review book. I reviewed it for the Chronicle.
Oh.
It was a $16 mat. I would never have bought it.
It looks like a fascinating book.
But they're not just, he has a brief summary of their criminal careers, and he tells you things about them, interesting anecdotes. And there ought to be a lot of material. It goes all the way from Puritan times. The first one of the men who came over on the Mayflower was finally hanged for murder. And the funny thing is that his descendants proudly claim him because that makes the Mayflower descendants, and they're somebody important, even if he was a murderer.
But you still prefer the whole field of crime writing?
I would rather, because I'm interested in the psychology of the criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And if he's a real person, naturally it's more interesting than having to make him up and provide his psychology.
What is most of your writing presently? What is most of your present writing on?
I don't know. Most of what?
Your present writing.
My present writing? Oh. Well, I think the first articles I ever had published were called A Girl on a Big City Newspaper. That was 1906. I was using the material at hand. But I can't say I had any particular line, because I wrote anything I could sell. I didn't write, most of my early work was nonfiction. Yeah. Jessica Mitford just sent me an advanced copy of her new book on prisons, which is going to... I asked to review it for the Chronicle. He'd already given it to Douglas Rigg, who used to be deputy warden. He's going to pan hell out of it. She hates everybody and everything. You know, it's hard to remember things that slide into each other, and
yeah.
I can't remember the... when or how or why one thing leads to another. You meet somebody or you... One of the things I always ask you now is where you get your ideas. Well, there's no answer to that.
I don't see how any writer can ever answer
three
that.
Finally, I just say out of my subconscious, but that isn't always true. Sometimes it's a newspaper story that... As I just... I just sold the TV rights in England to one of my very old stories, and I remember where that came from because it was a newspaper story about two brothers in Oakland, one of whom had disappeared one evening, leaving the radio on. They didn't have TV then, and all the lights on, never was seen again. And then his brother disappeared the same way a few years later, so I made up a family and got a reason why they disappeared. And that story has been reprinted over and over and over, and now it's going to be on TV and the commercial network in England. And the same way, one of my most reprinted stories came out of the Burton Abbott case, so it had, finally had nothing to do with it, but they, several people reported they had seen a girl struggling with a man in the car, and I began thinking, and they hadn't done it, they hadn't reported it or even got the license number. So I began thinking, what, under what circumstances would somebody act that way, and got my story out of that. But very often it's just something that suddenly strikes you from, of course, in science fiction, it's always what if. Mm-hmm. What if this or that happened? But
there's a science fiction piece. I'm not much of a science fiction or mystery reader. That my husband told me about, which apparently
well, it's, science fiction has changed
women.
Completely from the early days. The early, just as the early mystery stories were mostly puzzles or detective stories, you know, whodunit, mm-hmm. and the detective found out whodunit, and that was what you waited for. Now they're more interested in howdunit, which are the police procedurals, or whydunit, which is the psychological kind that I do. Well, the same way in science fiction. The very first ones were nothing much but very thinly disguised scientific articles. There was the I think the first science fiction novel in England in English was by Gernsback, Hugo Gernsback. That's why the science fiction awards are called Hugo's, and it was called Ralph something or other, a long list of numbers, and. It was supposed to be in the future, but it was actually a sort of treatise of mathematics and physics. And then we got the long time when it was the bug-eyed monster, and you went to Mars or Venus, and everybody in Venus had gills and swam in the ocean and all that, Venus probably. That was before they found out it had 500-degree temperature, and it was quite dry and sandy, just like the moon. They were really adventure stories with a scientific coding. They put them on another planet, and that would be bad. Gradually, we lost the moon. Now we've lost Mars, and we'll soon lose Venus. So we have to do something better. And then gradually, both science fiction and mystery have been getting into the mainstream. They're novels in their own right with their own people who are really real. And they are based, in science fiction, they're based on actual scientific, I think in the introduction to my collection, one of my collections of science fiction, I try to get the difference between science fiction and fantasy. And in science fiction, you have to extrapolate from a possibility. It may be a very improbable result, but for one thing, I don't think we'll ever have time travel, but that's a legitimate thing because you can extrapolate. But in fantasy, you get a complete impossibility, like one story I had about a man who turned into a Great Dane. Well, that's impossible and never will. But it made a good fantasy story what happened when his wife discovered that her husband had suddenly become a Great Dane.
Is there much use of science fiction material that deals with projected situations with women? There was a very early one, but
well,
someone with him, wasn't there?
There is now. In the early days, as I said, the woman was there only to be rescued or else to stand by admiringly while her great hero did things. But nowadays, women are often the protagonists, and there have been at least two recent science fiction books about sounds like John Knox's Regiment of Women. In other words, where things are exactly reversed. Well, I had one, a short story the same way, where a man is dropped on another planet by accident and finds out that it's just exactly the same sort of of sex-oriented chauvinism of the old days, only it's the other way around. Of course, men are less intelligent than women, everybody knows so. That sort of thing. The woman had the queen had a harem. She sent for the one she happened to want. And when if anybody makes an aggressive remark, so that's unmanly, you don't do that kind of thing.
Wasn't there a very early science fiction piece by someone named, I think it's Widham, W-Y-D-H-A-M, which was about women being in power? Do you recall?
I don't recall it. As I said, in the early days, I never read much of it. I've never read Ralph Waldo's numbers, and I never intend to. But I don't remember Widham either.
I'll look it up, because someone told me about it. It might be something that
I never happened to hear of it. But, of course, there's science fiction in other languages that is older than ours. I have an Austrian friend who is a science fiction fan, and has told me about several German writers that I didn't know about who were back in the, I don't know, the 1880s and 90s. And, of course, Jules Verne was all. But they, of course, were translated, and they did become popular. But this German, I can't think of his name now, they've just begun to translate some of these things.
Now, are you one of the few women in that science fiction group?
No, I should. That's another thing. In the early days, women practically never wrote it. But now I should say, well, it's hard to tell. Sometimes I take four science fiction magazines, and now this one, for instance, has Andre Norton as a woman, and Sonia Dorman. There are only two here, and Kate Willem, the three in this number by women. But there, sometimes there's none, sometimes there's one or two, sometimes there are more women than men. A good many women writing science fiction now. And the reason I think for that is that the first science fiction was dealt largely with engineering and technology, things that women were simply not working in and didn't have the background for. Now they deal often with sociological problems and also besides with biological. And most of the people, the women I know who are writing it, are interested primarily in that aspect. I mean, they're not physicists and not chemists. There's still quite a lot of science fiction that deals with theoretical physics. Well, I'd had physics in high school, and I had chemistry in high school and college, but I so long ago that I've forgotten most of it, and most of it is no longer valid. I remember using up most of my time in my college chemistry by teaching the teacher how to the Greek origin of the names of the elements. Well, not that I know. I think you milked me dry.
Remember that, yes. I never tried it. I remember hearing a Russian woman smoked in restaurants, and they were very liberated. No woman would have dared to do that.